We're going to have a split sermon today. Mr. Ron Dart and I decided to team up, and I said, Ron, I'm tired of this business of pecking order, so I would like you to go last. The last place, in the speaking schedule is always the one of honor. As I've said before, it is the one where you have an opportunity to bury everything the first guy said, and you will go home with the words ringing in your ear from the man who finally spoke. So we're going to have a split sermon today, and I'll try to keep my remarks within some sort of time parameter. We're going to have a gentleman who I hope finds where we are out here from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, who has already been in Pasadena to interview a number of people out there, and who is coming here. He had called about a week or 10 days ago, and is going to do a national broadcast interview of some sort. I don't know at what length, but the only way he could possibly do it was to get here today. So if you see me get up a little later, it's not because I don't want to hear Mr. Dart's sermon. I do want to hear it. It depends on what time the man arrives, and I will have to go and give him that interview at the office. And then, of course, Miss Consul has her tape recorder, and she's going to ask the questions for the French brethren, so I'll be speaking to them on tape a little later on this afternoon. I was going over one aspect of the Ten Commandments in my sermon before the Dallas-Fort Worth people Thursday night, in our campaign over there, that I've mentioned repeatedly in the past, and that is to muse how it would be in a nation such as ours if just one of the Ten Commandments were obeyed, even in the spirit, let alone in the letter. If you could pick any one of the Ten Commandments and simply apply what it would be like if all of your neighbors obeyed it perfectly, if all the people in the entire community in which you live and work, I mean from the top leaders in government to city government to people in business and people in law, if they all obeyed any one of those Ten Commandments. I spoke specifically about the one against murder and about hating your brother and applying that to society. I'd like to turn to Exodus, the 20th chapter, at the giving of the Ten Commandments of God, and look at the setting in which those commandments were given, and talk about one of the greatest of the commandments, and one which is certainly first among all of the other commandments. Chapter 20 and verse 1, the Eternal, or God, spoke all these words, saying, I am the Eternal your God, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, that first commandment is a commandment against idolatry. It is no mistake that the word idolatry begins with the letter I. Because the greatest possible form of idolatry is idolatry. Self-worship, self-assertion, the absolute conviction that you, inside yourself, of and by and for yourself, are right. You are right no matter what. Your perceptions, your ideas, your hang-ups, or your fears, your worries, your knowledge, the rumor you are telling as opposed to the one someone else is telling, you just know has got to be right. There are all sorts of forms of idolatry. The book of Isaiah says that we worship the things which our hands manufacture. In a sense, it overlaps when he says, you shall not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down yourself to them nor serve them. That's one form of idolatry. But I would submit, even though it is a very evil form of idolatry, it is not quite so horribly satanically protracted as the one which focuses on I. That is me, inside of me, because one might bring out the point that in pagan, heathen, polytheistic religions, their form of idolatry is at least outside themselves. It's abominable to God, but they are at least concentrating and worshiping at the idol that is supposed to picture God, whether it looks like a golden calf, Vishnu, Dagon, some other personality like Diana of the Ephesians that they have concocted in their own pagan minds. But the kind of idolatry I'm talking about is self-worship, the worship of self. I believe there are three possible words or definitions that tell you about total, utter, complete self. The first is like an instinct, and it's the instinct of self-preservation. The second is self-determination, that is self-government, self-rulership, self-decision. That you're your own boss, your own ruler. You always look inside yourself for your ideas.
It might be called one's own point of view, because you're a spark of life in the universe, and your perceptions are like a person who is in the middle of everything, because wherever you are, you're in the middle of what's going on. All the universe extends in every direction, equidistant, away from you. You are the center of your life. You are the center of what is happening. What happens only is really important as it affects you. Now think of cases where you have seen this in people's lives. I think of the case of the Kitty Genovese murder back in New York City, where some 20-some people in their apartment complex looked out, they heard the pitiful screams, the blinds went up, they peered out to see what was happening. Here was a woman who was being repeatedly stabbed, and she was crying out, "Save me, help me," and so on. Not one of those people wanted to become involved. Later on, when newspaper reporters began to interview some of the tenants in the apartment dwelling, they almost unanimously said they were afraid. What could they do? They didn't have a weapon. Maybe they were elderly. And none of them did anything, including they did not even call the police. They didn't think of going along and knocking on some other doors and saying, "Help us, we need to get several people together." They didn't even open the window and start throwing something out or screaming at the top of their lungs and trying to save the woman. And so she died. They didn't want to become involved. It wasn't really happening to them. It was happening to her. It was outside of them. It was away from them. They were not personally involved. It was some other human being. Have you ever been in the attitude driving along where someone does something that is very, very dangerous, which could have even gotten you into an automobile accident? Whip around a corner, run a stop sign, crash into a line of traffic, come the wrong way down a one-way street or something, and you just couldn't help yourself, so you said a lot of things you probably shouldn't have said. And at that specific instant in time, if that person had been smacked by a big Mack truck and had just gotten what we might be tempted to think they deserved, what would your attitude have been? Would you have said, "Well, the stupid character had it coming"? Aren't there times in our lives when, honestly, as we think of all of the entertainment that has formed and shaped our own personality and our own character, and you think about the kind and form of entertainment that we have grown up on and cut our teeth on, especially in this electronic era of television, aren't there times when you too have almost wanted to see the hero blow the guy away, just wipe out the villain, someone who has hurt you or done wrong? I'll never forget the one scene in a movie, which is a very effective scene because it had to do with pacifists, and I think in this case they may have been Quakers, maybe they were Mormons. It was back during the Revolutionary period, and here was this family. It was played by one of the real great, powerful, handsome, macho, very masculine and very strongly built actors of Hollywood. He was the husband, and here was the wife and several kids, and along came these foragers from the opposing enemy forces, came galloping across their farm and trampled underfoot the wife's vegetable garden. Well, the first horrible insult was that they took the family cow and let it off. And here was some of these, and they're always filthy, you know, ugly, one old snaggletooth kind of tobacco stain and all hairy, and you can almost smell them, you know, in the movie. And they're diving on the dirt of the road out there, catching this clucking, frantic chicken by the neck. And they go off with two of these chickens, slowly strangling, and stuff them in this gunny sack and stick it over their shoulder, you know, and jump on the horse and go roaring off. One of them has got this pig, and it's just squealing and so on. It's a horrible sign. Here are about 30 guys. They're trampling down. They're in the barn. They've got the cow, and it's lowing, and the little kid is out there, the little girl in her gingham dress, and they're crying. One of them knocks the kid aside. But the pacifist, the believer in God, the believer in turn the other cheek, he just stands there. You can see his jaw muscles kind of working, and the wife is wringing her hands and kind of pitifully crying. And these guys mount up their horses and they go roaring off and jump the fence and they're screaming whoopee and shooting their pistols in the air and they disappear. And the family tries to talk this over. Now what are we going to do? We're virtually broke. They took everything of any value. Now we don't even have any food. Well, the next scene. Here come these people back the second time. And this time they come into the house and they discover the pantry and they take the smoked hams. And now they find the geese and the ducks and they take them too. And now they ride off with his horse. Only this time they get drunk when they find some hard cider back there in the cooler, and then one of them begins to abuse the wife. You know, it really begins to get you, doesn't it? It starts to play on your emotion. This guy is standing there turning the other cheek. And so little by little, with your emotions just vicariously all very definitely involved in this, you're saying, you know, kill him. Get him. Grab that gun and do something. Well, ultimately, in this scene in the movie, as I recall it, this guy reaches his breaking point. The straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. And in an absolute mountain of rage, he just flies loose in all directions at once, and he just completely cleans up the house and the barnyard with about 14 of these filthy, depraved people, and you're sitting on the edge of your seat, and you're applauding, and you're cheering, and it's your fist hitting this guy, it's your bayonet puncturing his stomach, it's your bullet blowing his head off, and they're throwing cat's liver against the wall in slow motion, letting you see it. Yeah, I hope it's his stomach, you know. And maybe the entertainment of the modern world doesn't tend to vicariously affect you the way it does most people. But I think it does. I think it grinds away on you. I think it begins to rub calluses on your conscience. I think that without realizing it, from the days of a little child, when we heard our nursery rhymes, and from the days of the giants and maybe St. George and the dragon, all the way down to Superman and some of the fictitious characters that are still quite alive and well today in motion pictures, we tend to want to see evil stamped out by brute physical force. And this idea of a person who is his own boss and an absolute law unto himself, who can take the law into his own hands and can settle a matter by blowing away the opposition, it's part of American thinking. Now, years ago, I too was outraged when a black activist leader said, "Violence is as American as apple pie." I didn't like that statement about America. I took issue with that. I said, that couldn't be right. Most of us are non-violent folk. But it was a right statement. It was a correct statement. These motion picture and television interests could not make the money they do. They couldn't be in the multiple billions of dollars if violence didn't sell. Violence does most certainly sell. It's what does sell. Sex and violence, brutality and violence, any other kind of violence, any assorted kind of violence, whether it's in the family, between father and son, husband and wife, whether it's between neighbor, whether it's between the races, whether it's between religious or political forces, it is what sells in civilization and society. So, I have to ask the question, when you look at self, perfect self, self-preservation, self-determination, and self-perpetuation, how does this square with Jesus Christ of Nazareth and his example in his kangaroo court, his hastily rigged illegal trial, where they were dragging him to Anna's house and Caiaphas and to Herod and over to Pilate and back to Herod again and back to Pilate for the hand-washing ceremony and then over to the barracks to be lashed within an inch of his life and then dragged out and have the stake put on his back and stumble under the weight until they put it on another man and then finally crucified. What was the final straw that broke the camel's back to Jesus Christ? There never was the straw that broke the camel's back. Now that statement comes from an old fable, probably an Arab fable, about loading the camel, you know, with X number of bales of hay, and they're just putting straw after straw, and of course this seems to be ridiculous, but the camel's knees are all wobbly, and he's standing spraddle-legged, and his hump is now a bow, and finally they just put one more straw, and that's when the camel collapses. So in the old fable, there can eventually be that final little straw, as light as a feather, that you could blow away in the wind, which will break the camel's back. I have been recipient of a letter that said there was the straw that broke the camel's back. How many times have you run across Christian people who say, that did it? That broke it. I mean, that's it with me. That's all I can stand. Now, we have heard this so often. We've seen it in entertainment. We want to kind of come to that point in our own lives where it's heavy drama. You know, it's really dramatic if we can say, that did it. Now you understand a little about, you just broke my breaking point. Boy, that's all with me. Now we're ready for violence. No, Jesus Christ of Nazareth says there is no such thing as the straw that broke the camel's back with a Christian. One misapprehension people have about this precept of turning the other cheek is that it's a gimmick. They think it's a gimmick. They think that it would so awe and impress someone to see you slapped up alongside the head with a ringing blow that rings your bell and turn docilely the other cheek that your antagonist will be so overawed by your gentle Christianity that he'll probably drop to his knees and pray for forgiveness. But for to see him take a huge ham-fisted callous hand and wrap you up alongside the other side of your head, why, that's just unheard of. How in the world can that happen? How can Jesus Christ expect any Christian person to ever put up with that? People tend to think it's a gimmick. It's not a gimmick. It's the way you must conduct yourself, the way you must live if you expect to be in God's kingdom. Jesus Christ of Nazareth said, if they persecuted me, they will persecute you. And he said, you are not greater than your Lord. But really, in our own hearts and minds, oftentimes we think we are greater than our Lord. We wouldn't come out and say that. We don't really believe it in the sense that we go around saying, I'm bigger, I'm better, I'm greater than Jesus Christ. But what about this instinct, I call, of self-preservation? What about the desire to perpetuate the self? In the book that I wrote having to do with the Laodicean era, the idea of church eras, I said one of the great evils of this business of compartmentalizing various so-called phases or stages of the church is an escape mentality. And the people begin to believe that the greatest possible thing that could happen to them is to sneak off somewhere and to escape into a cave where no one could ever get at them, where they would not have to give any final testimony. They don't want to become a Stephen or a Paul or a James or brother of John or an apostle Peter, and certainly don't want to have happen to them what Jesus Christ had happened to him. And so they hope God will give them a better reward, some easier way than Jesus Christ had to go through, and they hope that they can escape. And really, I suppose within reason, within limits, God certainly expects and understands that desire that he built inside of us for self-preservation. If human beings, unlike animals, do have an instinct, we say that humans think and have a mind and animals have a brain and have instinct and only react automatically, almost like they're pre-programmed. But if we have an instinct, then the instinct for self-preservation is one of the most powerful of all instincts we have. But if you take the word self-determination, which is the perpetuation of one's own volition, of one's own will, one's own point of view, our own attitudes, then that is also a very powerful and a very strong instinct. Perhaps we could call it ego. That we are a law, almost like a god, unto ourselves. I said it is no accident that the word idolatry begins with I. Of course, that's a play on words, maybe. God didn't design the word in the English language that way, and that isn't what I imply. But the greatest possible form of idolatry is the worship of self to the point we really think we cannot be wrong. I was asked by a reporter yesterday who was writing an article for a major million circulation plus national magazine, Esquire. His name is William Martin. He was the man who wrote the first nationally circulated article critical of the Worldwide Church of God. I recall reading that article and thinking how fair it was. It appeared in Harper's back in 1971. I was a little upset about the plurality on the end of the name because it sounded to me like everything I had been saying, urging, and crying about, and urging my dad to do, or what have you, for a long period of time. I thought it was a terribly fair article. I know that in Reader's Guides in the libraries, you can go look up that issue of Harper's in a big public library. You could go back and you could read it, and you would see what I mean. He asked me near the conclusion of this long, it must have been how many hours? It seemed like it went nearly 4 hours. I was in the office, and he had tape recorders running, and he must have filled up about 3 or 4 tapes. He asked me at the end of it, what did I see as a potential pitfall in the idea of being a so-called charismatic leader and so on? I said, there are pitfalls. I have seen them happen to other people. I explained about our articles of incorporation and our bylaws, of our perception of church government as revealed in the New Testament, of the equality of the apostles, that my brother, Ronald Dart, and I are absolute equals, and I'm sure that I'm very inferior to him in some ways, but I intend, seeing that we have an active board, that board is already of 5, it will be 7, eventually I hope 15, including lay members, not in the employ of the church, so their loyalties are not to a paycheck. It's almost like you can see people in their mind's eye when a great issue is at stake, an issue of principle, where you would think they would just stand up and say, no, we will not go any further with this hideous thing that is happening here, but flashing like neon lights, as was brought out, I think, by one of the men in the office one day, is this huge paycheck. And they remember the signature that is on the bottom of that paycheck, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, his neon lights, blank, 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 paycheck, paycheck, paycheck. And so as one minister who has been a very close and a tremendous personal friend of mine has said repeatedly when it came to the issue of principle, he has said, I just pull a steel Venetian blind down over my conscience. He admits this cheerfully, freely, to other ministers and to his parishioners, to his congregation. He is doing exactly what we as Americans shake our heads and we just say, how in the world, when we read through what happened in the Nuremberg trials, when one leading Nazi official after another got up and said, it was the orders. I merely was following the orders of the Führer. It was his ultimate responsibility. I was a military man. I was just told to do as I was told. How and where and when does your loyalty to an organization, to a church, to a minister, as opposed to, and sometimes it is opposed to, your loyalty toward Jesus Christ of Nazareth, where do those come at loggerheads? Where do you peek around that man who is leading and say, is he still headed in the right direction? So I told this man, yeah, the first great big pitfall would be ego. It would be, as you look around and see a lot of people following you, the temptation to say they're following me because I am such a great guy. Nothing could be further from the truth. I've said repeatedly from the Feast of Tabernacles and before that the position of a minister in the Church of God International is to stand beside a member of the church and to point up to Jesus Christ and to say, look what a wonderful guy he is, but not to ever point to the minister and say, look at my power, at my authority, and what a wonderful man I am. In Matthew 16 and verse 24, Jesus said, if a man will become his follower, that he must deny himself. And in Romans 8, 7, it says, the carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. You're familiar with the 14th chapter of Proverbs, verse 12, and it's repeated in Proverbs 16, 25. It's twice in the Bible that there is a way which seems right in our own eyes. We are convinced of that. No one is quite as right as we are. And the final verse in the 21st chapter of the book of Judges, the bloodiest book in all the Bible, you hear of one war after another, one murder after another, one intrigue after another in the book of Judges. And at the very last verse, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now they are killing one another, but they're doing that which is right in their own eyes. Do you think that the Cambodians are right in their own eyes? Do you believe that the Vietnamese feel they are right in their own eyes? How else can you understand people who can be so fanatically dedicated to a cause? Bakhtiar won't last very long, so far as Khomeini over there near Paris in his little suburban villa is able to spew out the invective and saying we need the kind of a government where a man would cut off the hand of his own brother. We need the kind of a government that would be this absolutism, this autocracy, the unbelievable application of a religious fanaticism to a social and a political organism. And when you take religious fanaticism, even if it's the Arab Koran, and you apply that to a state, you have got yourself a tyranny such as the world has never known. And these screaming mobs, there are always the screaming mobs. There are always the masses. From time immemorial, people have leapt out of the arms of one despot into the arms of another. And you will probably see that they will replace the Shah for all the alleged, and it's probably true, brutality, the purges, the people jailed, the lack of civil rights. And of course, we righteously, sometimes selectively apply that. Our government seems to be a little self-righteous these days. We're doing business as usual with many nations who have despotic leaders who have taken away all civil rights, confiscated private property, kept the rifle squads busy, put people in concentration camps, like down in Mozambique, and we continue to do business with them. But in other cases, we say we will apply civil and human rights. And so they probably will leap out of the arms of the Shah into the arms of yet some other horrible dictatorship. Now the fears in the United States are that perhaps there will be a military coup, or at least if Bakhtiar does not last and Khomeini takes over and is brought back in some huge triumph, that maybe he will end up cooperating with the third world bloc, the Afro-Arab bloc, and that could be devastating if we lose a moderate voice in OPEC. And that's already set in motion anyway. We got 14.9% incrementally in four payments between now and October of 79, so you can expect further horrible pressures on the American economy as a result of that. Jesus said we are to deny ourselves, that the carnal mind does that which is right in its own eyes. We are convinced that we are right. Self-preservation and how it is manifested is that we always consider ourselves first in everything having to do with physical comforts, safety, avoiding problems, hurts, pain, sickness, accidents. And there are some few people now and then who overcome that, and they do almost impulsively overcome it. We've heard of some rare cases in warfare where a man has thrown himself headlong on a hand grenade just without thinking, almost automatically, who suddenly threw self-preservation to the winds and did a great and a noble act of complete martyrdom of self to save his own buddies. There are many cases like that. Cases of people snatching a child out of the path of an onrushing automobile and dying themselves. A case that I read of that was quite moving up in Shasta Lake in California. A car toppled off a ledge, overturned on its side. The woman got in, but the pressure of the water on the door wouldn't let her out. She rolled down the window. The water flooded the automobile. She couldn't get out, but she held her son up. And he got enough metal and so on under his little legs that there he was, shivering in the icy cold water, and they found the woman dead and her hand stiffened up there where she had held her child out of the window of the car. The woman didn't think of herself. She wanted that baby to be saved, and she died saving her child. That's an example when people throw to the winds self-preservation, so it can be done. It can be overcome. Not just through the teaching of Jesus Christ alone. Sometimes people who are non-Christian will still do that. Self-determination is voiced perhaps best in teenage, when we begin to say, no one is going to tell me what to do. I want to rule myself, go my own way, be my own boss. It's my life, and you're trying to live it for me, Mother. You're trying to tell me when to get in, and who my friends are, what I can do, and where I can go. At a certain point in life, we all rebelled against parental control to some degree or another, whether it had to do with smoking or dating or staying out late or going to the favorite drive-in or what we did in our automobiles or what we did in the parties that we stayed at other kids' homes. We always said, you just don't want me to have any friends. Now later on when you're 40 and you've got teenagers, these words come back to haunt you and it sounds so strange for you to be saying, yes, I do, but I just want you to have the right kind of friends. And why the kids can't see that the kind of friends you want them to have are the kinds that are better for them. But we must all learn those lessons. God has not left us to decide for ourselves what is right. He's only left us to decide whether we will obey that which is right. So we need to ask ourselves, are we allowing self-determination, self-preservation, and self-perpetuation, the idea that we will always be, to so dominate our thoughts that it influences decisions we make? I heard a very sad statement by a person recently. I was asking him about attending a place of worship, and he didn't want to go out there because he thought that the person who would be conducting the service probably was a little bit the kind of a person he didn't like. And I thought that was so sad. As I have asked and talked to the office staff and others in the past, can't we leave the so-called old politic behind? Jesus said, behold, all things are new. We need to start afresh. We need to leave the old politic behind. And as never before, we need to totally bury self. Romans, the 12th chapter and the first two verses are perhaps the best scriptures in all of the Bible about self-burial. I've said many times that perhaps the grisliest of all, I don't know if you'd call it a business or not, but way back in the early days of England, there were people who were, well, it goes back before that, the Arabs, and you can see that even in some of the greatest monuments and tombs of all, they were broken into long before the archaeologist's spade ever went clunk on the top of some sarcophagus somewhere. And so one of the grisliest occupations of history is that of a grave robber. And we're told in the 6th chapter of Romans that when we are buried with him by baptism into death, that our old man, as it says in Colossians 3 and Ephesians 4, is destroyed. And the analogy we're given in the symbol of physical baptism, of being immersed in water and then rising out of water, is to be dead and buried and to walk in newness of life as a picture of the death and burial and resurrection of Jesus Christ. A spiritual grave robber is a person who goes out, so to speak, and resurrects that ancient, old, sin-ridden corpse that is all emaciated and decomposed and dusts it off and brushes it off and cleans it up and says, I love that old body. I love the way it used to be. Maybe cancer-ridden and one lung gone or missing a limb or something and dying in a horrible disease if you look at the diseased spiritual body. But they dust it off and pick it up and say, it wasn't really that bad after all. We are spiritually grave robbers if we begin to reach back into our past lives and allow our hates, our petty jealousies, our little antagonisms and irritations, our point of view toward other people, some of the things that cause us pique, that we just wish other people wouldn't do, and we voice these objections. We say, I don't like so-and-so, and I don't like what she did or what he said. We are, when we do that, becoming spiritual grave robbers, and at the same time, we are idolaters because we are saying, I am so right. My apprehensions are perfect. My emotions are flawless. My point of view is better than any other point of view. The most common form of idolatry is the worship of self, not the worship of just an idol or an icon or even an automobile or something our hands manufacture, but the worship of our own ideas. We should be very, very leery of our own ideas. We should be very, very cautious, very aware of the fact every time we think some precept, some doctrine, some bit of knowledge, some story, some rumor we hear, instead of saying, oh, is that right? And that's an automatic response almost always when you hear a rumor. Is that right? There's a better response. You don't say, but turn that around. Don't say it, you. It's better to respond to people, well, that probably isn't right, and I think I'll suspend judgment on that because I really don't know the facts, and neither do you, or you wouldn't be telling me it's a rumor. Rumors are just that. They are rumors. They are not facts. And yet how often do you allow your viscera and your juices begin to flow because of the latest rumor you heard? You don't have the proof. You don't have the facts. You heard the rumor, and you begin to react emotionally to a rumor. Self-worship is the worst form of all idolatry. It says in Romans, the 12th chapter and verse 1, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And you're told, be not conformed to this world, this way. The Apostle Paul said that he did not judge according to what he called man's day or man's society, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God in your life. The transforming of your mind also means the transforming of your apprehensions, your attitudes. And there is a little bit of the idolatry of self that is buried inside every single one of us. There's not a one of us, including me, but what we have continually too much of the attitude, we are always right. No matter what you say to me, what I'm doing with it in my mind, I'm probably more correct than you are. That's not true. That's a self-deception. And it's a form of idolatry. So never forget, there must be some reason why the word idolatry begins with the letter I.